Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Kurdistan Connection with myself, Matt Broomfield. As regular listeners to this podcast will know, we seek to put the political situation in Kurdistan in a broader political, military and social context. And today we're going to be taking a slightly different approach to some of our recent discussions and looking at what's been happening latterly in Kurdistan and the politics of the Kurdish Freedom Movement with reference to some exciting new scholarship, which places that movement in the context of many centuries of political thought, political organizing, political struggles, failures, defeats, and also victories. And so I'm very happy to be joined today by Jeff Miley, who is an associate professor in political sociology at the University of Cambridge and has studied and worked in and through the Kurdish movement for many years, I believe. Jeff, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's very flattering to be asked to be on the program.
And we're very glad that you could join us today. Let's begin. You've written this book. The book is called Self-Determination Struggles.
There it is.
And I think the title suggests a bit, doesn't it? Self-determination is the thing we think of as a good thing, a right, is not without it. It's struggles in several senses. So perhaps you can just explain to us a bit, what's the history of this idea and why did you choose to write a book about it?
Well, I think that the notion of self-determination is somehow at the very core of the democratic ideal. And the idea that we should be able to exercise control over the forces that control us. And so self-determination is born alongside the principle of the sovereignty of the people. In the European context, if we're to believe much of the scholarship, although you have to be careful with the scholarship because Eurocentric scholarship reproduces itself. But anyhow, in the story of self-determination in Europe, it certainly is born alongside the sovereignty of the people. And there are various iterations of the idea of self-determination in the 19th and 20th into the 20th century, but they became a sort of dominant standpoint for the international order as well. So it is both born out of the struggle for the sovereignty of the people and also against empire. So self-determination emerges in the 20th century in the African context, in the Indian context, as a claim for self-determination, government of a people, a nation against an imperial understanding. So there are multiple iterations of the idea of self-determination, and it remains, I would say, at the core of the democratic ideal. It need not be associated with the national question only, but it can also we can think about the self-determination of workers over the conditions in which they work. So that's the self-determination, I think, is at the core of the democratic ideal. And I think that one of the things that I really, as you can see from the cover of the book, I'm very much a fan of Abdullah Öcalan. I think Öcalan's rearticulation of self-determination for the Kurdish movement born as a Marxist-Leninist guerrilla strategy for national self-determination. But Öcalan, particularly since his imprisonment, but even before, began to articulate an understanding of self-determination that doesn't necessarily mean an aspiration for a nation state. And there, I think Öcalan's rearticulation of self-determination is world historic. And with the revolution in Rojava, the significance of the project catches the revolutionary imagination on the left more generally. And that's how two of us. Where are you from, Matt?
England.
England, okay. I'm from California, and both of us somehow have been brought into the orbit of this world historical force, which is the Rojava Revolution.
As you say, I think maybe for people who followed a bit the Kurdish movement, particularly in England or America, there's often this idea: okay, Öcalan's group was more or less Marxist-Leninist. Then he went to prison. He read Bookchin, and then he changed his ideas. Which is part of the story, but perhaps it's not the whole story. You also relate Öcalan to some of these like other post-colonial thinkers and post-colonial struggles. Yeah. Yeah. Could you speak a bit about that?
I think there's an affinity between the call, which is very in vogue in the academy, to decolonize things, and the way in which Ojolon builds upon mainly upon Wallerstein with respect to the world systems theory. So Ojolon has a rearticulation of self-determination that goes along with that has an affinity with all sorts of accounts from Mignolo, who's calling for to the Zapatistas. To the Zapatistas as well, there's a elective affinity between the things that Ojolon is calling for and things that are happening broader on the left after the demise of the state communist project, so to speak. So I think that Ojolon and the movement, the Kurdish movement, born as a movement of national liberation, nonetheless can transcend even its national underpinnings and sort of be at the forefront of the theory of freedom, understood as self-determination in the 21st century. And there, I think Ojolon's it's way oversimplified to say that Ojolon went to prison, read Bookchin, and then voila. There's a turning of Ojolon already in the 1990s, a calling for peace process, all these sorts of things, a real set of reflections that are born from the death of the state communist ideal. And for that reason, I don't think it's a mistake or a coincidence that there's an elective affinity between Ojolon's thought and all other kinds of decolonial thinking. Though that decolonial thinking is quite at home in the academy, and I think Ojolon remains difficult to get Ojolon the respect that he deserves as a thinker taken seriously in the academy. So I think in part what I do in the book as well is to try to center the importance of the Kurdish movement in thinking through the question of self-determination and think through it at the same time. But I'm trying to help raise the profile, the intellectual profile and prestige of the thought of Abdullah Ocalan, which has been just very impressive what he's done in the period since he has been imprisoned, just in terms of as a kind of existential resistance, as a symbol of resistance, the fact that he's been so prolific. Those of us who are academics and we spend all our time in these big libraries and have access to all the books and can't come up with anything, and Ojolon gets access to minimal books, and what he comes up with is not unproblematic, as you may know. I mean, people have I think rightly accused him of being anti-Semitic in some ways. Other people, myself included, I've talked about the way in which the African history is sort of given short shrift in the meta narrative that he tells. So I'm not for treating Ojolon as divinely inspired, so to speak, but I do think he's a very important leader with an intellectual strength as well, and not only intellectually strong, but also the leader of this very strong movement, which is one of the only bright spots in the planet right now, right? To be honest, with all we can say to criticize the revolution in Rojava, it does burn the revolutionary flame.
For sure. So maybe I wanted to, so as you mentioned, obviously, you know, Ojolan's thought comes in kind of clear response to the collapse of the Soviet Union at the beginning of the 1990s, and is kind of trying to build and go on from there. That was now 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Best part 30 years ago. Has the left kind of managed to develop and learn itself from those failures? Has it managed to create a critique of the Marxist-Leninist model of state socialism, or is it still kind of, does it still need to hear these lessons that are being put forward by Ojolon?
I think it still needs to hear the lessons being put forward by Ojolon, yeah. I do think that there has been some soul searching on the left, and that's why I say that it's not a coincidence that there seems to be this elective affinity between what Ojolon comes up with and what other people on the left come up with in the wake of the failure of the Soviet experience. I think that the left in the advanced capitalist core, so to speak, or the center, the metropole of the world system, that the idea of self-determination for in the core seems very far away.
Sure. I mean, so, okay, as often then when people now speak about some of the ideas and going beyond these sort of conventional political models of like state socialism, for example, they mentioned these two examples you've mentioned already, Rojava, the Kurds, and the Zapatistas, and these are the kind of two sort of big examples now of, you know, these are kind of the...
Well, most of the left in the advanced capitalist core gets on board with, so here in Britain, the Jeremy Corbyn phenomenon was quite big. In the United States, you had the Bernie Sanders people, the people that are behind the Squad and stuff like this. And so I still think that social democracy remains hegemonic on the left. In some ways, but those social democrats are in connivance with, let's say, the still Marxist phase in terms of the sort of a kind of hierarchy within the movements that they speak about, and then there is also an anarchist kind of left, and that anarchist left is the one that looks quite closely to the Rojava revolution and feels all kinds of excitement around it. So that's an interesting affinity between the anarchist movement and the, but the anarchist movement in the capitalist core, I think would do well to think about ways in which the Rojava revolution could spread beyond the revolutionary core. But that would take mean looking at, for example, Africa. And one of the things that I've been involved in with the Struggles for Self-Determination project is to look at the ways in which there are places in Africa, in the ghettos of Africa, in the informal settlements of Africa, where people, when they hear the message of Ojolon about self-determination as radical direct democracy against the state, they get very excited about that. And I think that there's potential to spread the good news that Ojolon brings, and yes, proselytize for some theoretical and strategic reorientation of grassroots political movements in accordance with this dialogue with that Ojolon has so usefully sparked.
Yeah, because I mean, you also suggest in like a broader sense in your book that current calls for like decolonization are they mark a desire to go beyond just the process of achieving your own colony, sorry, your own state after being formally decolonized.
Yes.
And so you mentioned, for example, looking at Africa, is this a kind of a process that you see developing across the world today?
The project that I'm working on right now, getting it into book shape, is a project that's born out of an essay that I wrote last year called I Dreamt I Was a Rasta. And this was about my experiences in the ghettos of Nairobi with Rastafarian elements associated with these community empowerment groups that have been springing up for the last decade, and talking to them about Ojolon's ideas and the way in which they got very excited when I started talking to them about Ojolon's ideas. And they saw a continuity between what Ojolon was saying and the land and freedom movement, the Mau Mau movement, where they have posters, murals of Dedan Kimathi, who was the leader of the Land and Freedom Movement, and was murdered by the British. And they say, well, Ojolon brings the same message as Kimathi, our great leader Kimathi did. So I see that in the ghettos where people have nothing to lose but their chains, there is a lot of openness towards a tactical and strategic reorientation that allows that in some respect they already imbue that ethos already, the struggle to resist the kind of neo-colonial and neoliberal capitalism that dominates, that smashes their existence.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. So maybe we can just sort of let's just step back then a little bit. So in this book, you speak a lot about the confluence between some of the ideas you put forward and how they are also represented, also explored and advanced powerfully by Ocalan. Like, you were interested in these question of self-determination, and you then came across Ocalan, were like, okay, he's saying something similar, or he inspired your thoughts, or what was the process there?
So have been interested in the questions of nation and language and state. Since growing up in California, I was already interested in lots of questions like that. But my dissertation was on language, politics, and nationalist conflict in Spain, and in Catalonia in particular, but also in comparison with the Basque Country. So I was fluent and versed in the self-determination struggles in Europe, and was always from some kind of libertarian socialist critique of the nation. I took Rosa Luxemburg's thought really seriously. I think that she has a very prescient kind of criticism of nationalism and the way that nationalism can creep its way into the movement. Anyhow, my work on Spain was largely a kind of left wing critique of the limits of the bourgeois nationalist projects that are certainly in Catalonia, to a lesser extent in the Basque Country, embodied in these kinds of these movements. But so at Cambridge, I was teaching this, and I started getting students from all over the world coming because people were interested in self-determination struggles to come and study at Cambridge. And one of the persons I was fortunate enough to come across was Dilar Dirac. Dilar Dirac, who became my student, and I learned more from her than she ever learned from me, that's for sure. I love learning from students. As she invited me to come to Rojava in December of 2014, and I was part of an academic delegation. What I saw in Syria, in the northeast of Syria, and I was there for under 2 weeks, but what I saw was very, very interesting to me. Having been so familiar with the Spanish context, I was quite infatuation with the anarchist revolution in Spain in 1936, but I thought of revolutions as something that belonged to another time. And to be in a space where there's a revolution happening in the present, it was in some respects quite exhilarating experience. And from there, I got incorporated into the Peace in Kurdistan campaign against criminalization of communities, the EUTCC, all these different kinds of organizations were looking for people like myself, have the academic credentials that I have to help defend the movement in Europe. So I've lobbied in the Parliament, the European Parliament, at the Council of Europe, and also in the UK. I've engaged in several close to a dozen meetings in the Parliament, trying to get people to reconsider the war on terror framing and the atrocious politics surrounding the Kurdish question in the European core, and in particular in the United Kingdom.
So as you say, going to Rojava, if there's the opportunity, engaging with Ocalan's ideas, it can be and is in a very exhilarating, very exciting thing.
Yeah.
So far from my conversation, I suppose this kind of model before Ocalan's come out is the best thing going today. But do you also see from your analysis and your research issues, problems, contradictions with either the way things are being implemented in Rojava or with this thought as a whole? What are the potential pitfalls ahead?
Yeah, I mean, I think, of course, any revolution, in order to survive, it has to spread in a way. And I think that the difficulty that the Kurdish revolution has in Syria is that it's surrounded by such implacable foes. It's sort of forced to be co-opted, in a sense, to be crushed, or perhaps to be both, if it doesn't somehow spread. And in order for the revolution to spread, also we have to have a kind of critical assessment of what have been the strengths and the limitations of the revolution. And I think where the revolution has been very good at acceding to political power, the question of the transition to democratic confederalism and what are the prospects of step moving towards that, given the environment of the war economy and the surrounding war conditions. So Yeah, I don't think that being supportive of the Kurdish movement, that it's supportive to support them without being critical at the same time, because we can provide, by providing a critique in our support, it also helps engage in a dialogue which overcomes like a kind of neo-colonial aspect where we start talking to each other as equals, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think then that the Kurdish movement could stand to learn, or is learning from lessons that developed following the 1917 revolution? And then, so I suppose kind of we maybe think more about, okay, the Kurdish movement has recognized that the issues with state socialism as it developed, and it wants to avoid doing that. But is it also important to look at how the Bolshevik party kind of transitioned to this huge state apparatus?
I think that one of the things with respect to the Kurdish movement is that the Kurdish movement is born out of a Marxist-Leninist guerrilla, and the transition to democratic confederalism from a Marxist-Leninist guerrilla has certain kinds of contradictions in that to begin with, you know. So and more generally, if you think about the introduction of revolutionary ideals, it's never going to enter in sort of at all sectors of society at the same time. There's always going to be a minority which is ahead of the vanguard, at the head of. And so then the question is how do you orient your own direct positionality as being ahead of. And I think that the spirit of Öcalan is great, because Öcalan is what I would say he argues for a self-liquidating leadership, that as people look to him, he says, look to yourselves, it's in yourselves that you see the struggle. So with respect to the whole question of the vanguard, I think that the vanguard has to be committed to self-liquidation. But I don't know if that answers your question exactly. But
no.
No, it doesn't answer your question.
No, yes, it does.
Okay.
I think it's a no indeed. I was trying to express.
Yes.
We could talk a lot more about these issues we've raised today, and we've covered a lot of historical political ground, but we are coming to the end of our conversation. Maybe just let me ask you for like a final question.
Sure.
You've written this book, what do you kind of hope for it to achieve? Is your aim to start more of a conversation within the Kurdish movement, or within those around the Kurdish movement, to bring these ideas into the academy?
I think a little bit of both. A little bit of both. I wanted to engage the Kurdish freedom movement's set of ideas with a broader history on the left of thinking through some of these questions of self-determination, to put Öcalan as his role as a world historical figure, to put him at the center of the discussion, I think is something that people in the movement are happy to see happen. And I think that there's also some space in the academy for given the grassroots appeal and support. So this is the first volume. There's a variety of projects that I'm working on all around the whole question of self-determination, understood along Öcalan-esque lines. And in that respect, I have another book coming out on the question of lessons from Rojava for the paradigm of social ecology, which we're going to get. We're in the midst of asking people to help write some critical reviews of that, and publish that as a collective volume to get people really thinking about the contradictions of the revolutionary situation in Rojava. And furthermore, working on self-determination struggles around the world with a particular focus on Africa. As I told you, I do all this work in Nairobi with the grassroots liberation movement, which is associated with the Social Justice Center Network. And the idea there is to spread the ideas of Öcalan beyond the Kurdish core into places where we can then translate it into the as part of a revolutionary pantheon, Öcalan being an internationalist figure, linking up with the Pan-Africanist visions as well. So all of those are works in progress. And I really, really thank you for sharing my book and my ideas with people on your platform. And please feel free to get in touch with me. I'm very interested in these issues. So
absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Jeff, for joining us today. I really enjoyed this conversation and getting to have a chat myself. And I'm sure our listeners will also be very interested in these ideas as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Us.
And this has been the Kurdistan Connection with myself, Matt Broomfield. Until the next episode. Goodbye.